Well, we're back to our Redeemer King series, very slowly working through Matthew's Gospel, one of the greatest things ever written. And the purpose of it and why we're looking at it is that it's all about what it means to be a follower or disciple of Jesus. It's about him, but it's also about what following him looks like in real everyday life. As we go through this book, you'll have found we bump into all sorts of topics, and today is one of the less fun things. It's something that's hard to make jokes about. It's the topic of divorce. And I wouldn't imagine anybody in this room got up this morning for church and thought, you know, I'd love it if there was a message on divorce today. Oh, that would really scratch an itch for me. I hope it's about divorce. None of us thought that, obviously. But the reality is, regardless of our own situation, all of us will sadly encounter divorce, either personally or through somebody that we know. It's so prevalent, we will not avoid it in life. One thing I've observed since coming to Maybridge is that there's quite a lot of people in this church who have personal experience of divorce. Many also have experience of remarriage after that divorce. All sorts of stories and all sorts of reasons. For some of us, even the word divorce brings up painful memories we'd rather not think about. But while it's not the most attractive topic, it is important. Jesus speaks into it. And although divorce carries all sorts of sadness and disappointment, of course, there is hope. With him, there is always hope. Before we look at Jesus says, just quickly, a little bit of insight into divorce in our country right now. Firstly, please do excuse me, by the way, if I have repeated coughing fits throughout this talk. Why people get divorced? Oh, we don't have that on the screen. I'll just tell you, though. Okay, unreasonable behaviour is cited by 45% of cases. It covers a number of things. Basically, it refers to either party behaving so badly that the other half of a couple can no longer stay with them. This could include physical violence, verbal abuse, addiction, refusing to pay for expenses related to the home. Separation, very vague term, is 40% of divorces. You could call this a drifting apart. People cite a lack of intimacy or poor communication. Adultery is cited in 14%, so one in seven divorce cases. Did you know this week it was released, where is the adultery capital of the UK? Do you know where it is? Guildford. You wouldn't have thought, would you? I don't know why, but you're just like, that feels surprising to me. Anyway, and then 1% are desertion. Although rare, desertion is in 1% of divorce cases. This is where either partner unexpectedly leaves without good reason and has been away for more than two of the last 2.5 years. What's clear in all of these cases is that there has been a failure to love somewhere along the way. That's the consistent thing with divorce. In modern language and in the courts, you can get a no-fault divorce, which is convenient legal language, but in relationship terms, there has always been a failure to love by one or both parties in a divorce. And it causes a lot of damage, not only to the couple getting the divorce either. So the statistics that are on the screen. As of 2021, the divorce rate in the UK is 42%. More than 4 out of 10 marriages end in divorce. In this country, we have one of the worst marriage success rates in the world. The most common years of divorce are the first, second, seventh, and eighth of a marriage. So you might have heard that phrase about a 7-year itch. Well, that does seem to play out in the stats. But the first and second year, I mean, you've just got married, and there's a lot of experience of people getting divorced then. Divorce couples where they separate and then remarry to somebody else only have a 31% of their marriage ending in divorce, which is better than 42%, but it's still nearly one in three people. If they remarry, they get divorced again. That's the stats. People who experience divorce face, this is documented, a variety of psychological issues, including increased stress, lower life satisfaction, depression, increased medical issues, and an overall increase in mortality risk. In other words, it badly affects your health on every level to get divorced, not surprisingly. Children raised by stably married parents tend to be healthier, better educated, and more likely to avoid crime and poverty than those who experience transitions in family structure. This is not a fashionable thing to say, but from a statistical point of view, the data is overwhelming. does not mean that if you or your friend got a divorce, they're automatically a bad parent with bad kids. It does not mean that. And it might well have been in their circumstances that getting a divorce had wisdom to it. But in general, when marriages work, it's better for everybody, especially children. It's incontrovertible. Married parents are more likely to stay together than cohabiting ones. In fact, 2/3 of cohabiting parents split up before the child reaches age 12, compared with 1/4 of married parents. That's an enormous difference. And you might all hear the popular thing these days of, oh, let's not bother with marriage, let's just live together. But if you are married and then you have children, you are far, far, far more likely to stay together. You just are, statistically. Family breakdown, money's not the most important thing, but family breakdown costs an estimated $46 billion a year, so it's comparable to the national defence budget. A study found that 2/3 of unhappy married people who stayed together were happy 5 years later. They also found that those who divorced were no happier on average than those who stayed together. In other words, most people who are unhappily married tend to become happy if they stick at it in general, and people who get divorced in general don't tend to feel any better. That's quite hard to measure because we're talking about feelings, but that does seem to be a thing. So divorce, therefore, is a huge problem, and it's not new. In first century Israel, you might be surprised to learn, marriage and divorce was a hot topic. Jesus gets asked about his views for it, and he challenges how many people today might think of marriage and divorce. So this is from the start of Matthew chapter 19. When Jesus had finished saying these things, he'd been teaching, he left Galilee and went into the region of Judea to the other side of the Jordan. Large crowds followed him, and he healed them there. Some Pharisees came to test him. So a little bit of context. Jesus has been teaching in the previous chapter. He now moves to the Judean countryside. Crowds follow him. He heals people, which is, of course, is amazing. The Pharisees, who are a group of religious leaders, come to test him. They don't care if Jesus heals everybody on earth. They want to know if he's theologically legitimate. Is he sound, basically? Does he have the right beliefs, according to them? In fact, they've already decided that he doesn't at this point. They don't like him, and this chat is all designed to catch him out. But what's really interesting is that Matthew, the author, does not tell us all the stories of these healing miracles that seem to happen at this point, which we would be interested in. He chooses to give the detail on a technical legal argument about divorce. That's what he tells us. We're supposed to read and understand this. Not right now, it's not about the miracle stories. They are fun. It's about what Jesus says about divorce. And here's the big question that the Pharisees ask him. Here we go. They asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? First thing to say, what a horrible question. What a horrible question. At this time, men tended to have the power in marriages, and a woman could maybe get a divorce if she was rich or well-connected, but otherwise, even in an abusive situation, the courts would have to impose the end of a marriage if they felt that it was the right thing to do. So basically, if a couple at this time and place got divorced, it was generally the choice of men. And there were two very influential rabbis who some years earlier had shaped the sort of the conversation on divorce. And it was all about how you understood what the Old Testament said. And Rabbi Shammai said, well, you can only get divorced if there's sexual immorality. In other words, if your wife sleeps with somebody else, you can get a divorce. Otherwise, no. Rabbi Hillel, on the other hand, said you could get a divorce for any reason, if you're a man, from bad cooking to breaking a pot to finding another woman more attractive. I don't think we like him in this room, do we? At the time, though, of Jesus, the views of Hillel were more popular. But either way, the whole debate around marriage was thought of in terms of, well, what's legally allowed? What can I get away with as a man, basically, rather than a relationship between two people? And in many ways, we might be shocked by the Hillel view, but it's really not that different to the modern notion of freedom. We might find it distasteful if someone left their spouse because they made a bad risotto or they went off with someone they met at work. But we also really like freedom, and we understand freedom as doing what suits you. And so in some ways, it's really not that different to our popular cultural views now. But the question was meant to be a trap. If Jesus says, well, I agree with Shammai, then the Pharisees will probably go and tell Herod, who was in charge of the land where they were talking. And he had just not that long ago divorced his wife for very bad reasons. And John the Baptist told him off, and he had John the Baptist killed. And so they're thinking, well, maybe if we can get Jesus to say the same stuff as John the Baptist, Herod might kill him as well, and we'd quite like that. On the other hand, if Jesus agrees with Hillel, we're going to say he's going against the Bible. He's a bit dodgy theologically. He's against God. And so it's actually quite a clever trap. It's like facing Jeremy Paxman on Newsnight, and he's pushing you into a corner and trying to get a controversial answer. Unfortunately for the Pharisees, they're facing Jesus. And this is the reply. "Haven't you read," he replied, "that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two but one flesh. Therefore what God has joined together, let no one separate." This is such a good answer. The first thing Jesus does is to say, "Haven't you read?" I can't tell you in the Jewish way of debating how much of a smackdown this is to the Pharisees. It's like he said, "Oh, guys, have you not read the Bible?" I've got to be honest, I'm surprised. I thought that was, you were all about knowing this stuff. Obviously, you've missed something. It's a little bit embarrassing for you, but don't worry, I'll explain it. That's basically what he's saying. But more seriously, in the Jewish way of understanding the Bible, the further back you went, the more authority your interpretation had. The further back you went in the Bible. And the Pharisees were referring to what was in Deuteronomy, the fifth book of the Bible. They're debating that, but Jesus says, no, I'm going to take you back to Genesis, right at the beginning, the intention, subverts all their ideas. No, let's get back to the origin of marriage. What is it supposed to be? And in Genesis, it's God who institutes marriage, not people. And this makes all the difference. It means marriage is not a man-made thing there for our convenience. It's actually woven into the fabric of human relationships to develop, to benefit the individual and the society. That's why at marriage ceremonies, we say these words, "What God has joined together, let no one separate." If you've ever been to a Christian wedding, you will have definitely heard that. The aim, as God intended, was that marriage was a permanent, unbreakable connection between husband and wife, that they become one unit in a way that doesn't happen in any other relationship. This, by implication, also sees husband and wife as co-equal partners and rubbishes any idea that a husband can see his wife as disposable for the smallest reason. So Jesus steps away from the Hillel and Shammai debate and says, you've got to see the bigger picture. It's not just a technical debate about what's allowed. No. This is how it's meant to be. This is the healthy vision for marriage. It starts with God. It's meant to be permanent. Two people of equal worth. And so divorce it's not just some courtroom paperwork. It's like an amputation. Divorce is like an amputation. That's how severe and problematic it is and why it's so far from what God intended. So this is a great answer from Jesus, but it doesn't close everything down. "Why then," they asked, "did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away?" Jesus replied, "Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard, but it was not this way from the beginning. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another woman commits adultery." So the Pharisees don't like the Genesis answer. They still want to focus on the Deuteronomy stuff. That's where we see what Moses taught. That's what they're talking about. They're saying, okay, Jesus, that's okay, fine, that's true. But Moses did say, and it is in the Old Testament, that divorce is okay. So what do we do with that then? What's your answer? Now notice that even in this follow-up, they still see this from a very sort of male convenience perspective. And they also use the word command. Moses commanded that a man divorce his wife. And Jesus immediately changes this to permitted. That's a big difference. A command is something you have to do, but to be permitted is a concession. It's allowed, but it's not necessarily good. It's not necessarily preferable. And Jesus is saying divorce was not the intention, but it's there because in the real world, people sin. People mess up their marriages. And so divorce exists as a sad but necessary thing. And he says, and I think he chooses this phrase very deliberately, "This was because your hearts were hard." It's quite a chilling phrase. In the Old Testament that the Pharisees did actually know very well, that phrase was used lots of times about one person. When the Jews were being held captive in Egypt by Pharaoh, it says a number of times that his heart was hard. In other words, Pharaoh, who's one of the big bad guys of the Old Testament, was selfish and uncaring and opposed to God. By saying your hearts are hard, Jesus is saying divorce exists because people behave like Pharaoh. Divorce exists because people behave like Pharaoh. I mean, to the people listening, this was very strong, almost offensive language. And so divorce can never be looked at as a sort of convenience option. It's always the result of somebody's hard heart, either both of the couple or just one of them. Divorce is always a failure of love somewhere along the way. But Jesus anticipates why people, especially men, in his society got a divorce, and he's super clear about what they're doing. I should say, by the way, that 99% of the time, people only got a divorce in that day in order to marry somebody else. It wasn't just about paperwork, it was because they wanted to marry somebody else. And he's addressing them as men, remember, and saying, if you guys divorce your wife for any reason that's not that she's been unfaithful, it's not a legitimate choice. You shouldn't do it. So all that getting divorced because your wife broke a bowl or you don't like her haircut or you saw someone you fancied more at the synagogue, that's a load of nonsense. And you're going against God if you get a divorce for those reasons. But he does give the only legitimate reason for divorce. And here it says sexual immorality. And different translations of the Bible will put this differently. And the reason is, the Greek word that's translated here is porneia, which is where we get the word pornography from, which often means adultery, like, you know, you've slept with somebody else. But it can, and often does in those times, have a wider meaning of unfaithfulness. And I think Jesus is pointing to unfaithfulness, not only sexual adultery. So in one way, he's being very specific about the times that divorce is legitimate, but in another way, he's widening it to things the Pharisees would not have considered because it wasn't really what they were thinking about. What is unfaithfulness, though? I think it's these four things. Firstly, it can be sleeping with another person. That's straightforward, a physical relationship. But also, it can be an emotional overcommitment to another person. And this is more subtle. You might have heard the phrase, an emotional affair. This is where somebody, although it's not physical, develops an intimacy and closeness to somebody who's not their spouse that is inappropriate. That's a thing too. Thirdly, somebody could commit adultery with something else, like a hobby or a work or something like that. This is where somebody becomes more committed to an activity or an idea than their partner. Again, this could be subtle, but if, for example, somebody never saw their spouse because they worked every hour of the day and refused to change, that's a type of unfaithfulness. It's deserting the marriage for another priority. And then finally, a type of unfaithfulness is abuse. Sexual, emotional, financial, verbal, physical. Abuse is definitely a type of unfaithfulness in any form. Seeking to control or hurt your spouse is an act of adultery. Again, you need huge wisdom here when thinking about what the abuse is, how severe it is, how regular it is, what's the right way to respond. And we have to say some of these could be more nuanced. For example, if somebody was hitting their spouse, that is a type of unfaithfulness, that's clear. But if somebody spends all their energy outside the marriage over a period of time, neglecting the marriage won't change, at what point is pursuing a divorce reasonable? That's hard to discern. That probably needs prayer and discussion with other people. Personally, there are two times in my life when I've advised somebody who asked my opinion to seek a divorce. In both cases, I knew there was clear ongoing abuse by the other person, and I didn't take it lightly. If it had been one instance of abuse, one time, I guess it would depend what it was, I don't know. These things need great wisdom. And note that Jesus said divorce is permitted, not required. You don't have to. I mean, if the other person wants to, you probably don't have a choice, but you don't have to. And there are wonderful stories of forgiveness and reconciliation. We should long for those. But equally, that's not always what happens. And situations can be very different. So Jesus agrees with neither Hillel nor Shammai. He emphasizes a merciful approach in unfaithful situations, not normally associated with those who are traditionally conservative, and a very high view of the importance and permanence of marriage, not normally associated with more permissive liberals. He keeps the door open for remarriage, but only in the situation where the person who has been the victim of unfaithfulness has good grounds for getting a divorce in the first place. This is all hard stuff, isn't it? Which is why Jesus' disciples, who are not trying to test him, comment on it. We haven't got a slide for this because these are the Breakfast Church slides. My apologies. I'll read this to you. This is the next bit of Matthew 19. The disciples said to him, "If this is the situation between a husband and wife, it is better not to marry." Jesus replied, "Not everyone can accept this word, but only those to whom it has been given. For there are eunuchs who were born that way, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by others, and there are those who choose to live like eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. The one who can accept this should accept it." So the disciples are struck by how strong Jesus' view is on the permanence of marriage, and they say, "Whoa, that's heavy. Maybe it's just better not to get married then. That'd be easier." And they're thinking, if this is the standard, are we just better off staying single? You know, we don't want to get embroiled in a marriage. If it's that permanent, I'm not sure I want to be stuck in that. Maybe I should just avoid it. And in a sense, it's good that they react this way, and so should we. We should take marriage so seriously that we take a long pause before committing to a permanent relationship. And Jesus says not all can accept this. And he starts talking about eunuchs, not a common word in our society. And it may seem a little bit odd. Eunuchs at that time were men who were castrated in their youth so they could serve in certain service roles to the rich and powerful. And they would not normally have been married. And eunuchs, who Jesus says were born that way, that's probably a way of describing people with physical issues that meant they could not be sexually active. And Jesus also mentions those, and this is important, who live like eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. In our language, people who have deliberately chosen to be single so they can focus on God. What Jesus is talking about across these three types, all these different types of eunuch, are people who are single, either because of circumstances or because they chose to be. And we should remember, it's quite possible that as Jesus never married, he was called a eunuch in a derogatory way by his enemies. That's probably something that happened to him. But in these words, in what to us is quite an unusual way of putting it, he's saying there is great value to singleness. Whatever the reason, and when marriage sounds really hard and divorce is really bad, singleness may suddenly seem more appealing. There's value to singleness and single people. And of course, those who get divorced can suddenly find themselves single when they hadn't planned to be, and there's value to those people too. And so all in all, Jesus is strong on marriage, he takes divorce very seriously, but also because he puts value on singleness, he makes it clear marriage is not the be-all and end-all. It's important. Don't make it ultimate in your life. It's great, but don't make it ultimate. So before I finish, I want to share just a few practical thoughts because, as I said, divorce is sadly a practical subject and we will all bump into it. So just a few thoughts when we do. Firstly, for those who are considering marriage, just some things for maybe you to dwell on. Know that choosing a spouse is a spiritual act. It's intended to be permanent. It's not just finding somebody attractive. Next, understand and commit to God's view of marriage, not the world's. As we've seen from the stats, the world's view of marriage isn't great. Commit to God's view of marriage and you'll be better off for it. Remember, love is not just a feeling, in opposition to that famous song. Love is not just a feeling, it's a choice. Feelings are involved, but it's a choice. And if you go into marriage with that basis, you'll be so much better off. Next, and this is a little bit of a perhaps unfashionable one, ask for the opinions of your friends if you're considering getting married. Before Naomi and I got married, I didn't ask any of my friends if it was a good idea because I knew that I was really getting the best of the deal. Naomi, on the other hand, asked lots of people if they thought it was a good idea, which was extremely sensible, and sadly her friends let her down and she ended up marrying me. But again, we're often very independent, but talking to people who know you and the other person is a really great idea. Next, talk clearly about expectations before you get married. It's lovely that churches do marriage prep material. Anybody ever done marriage prep material before they got married? It's so helpful. I've done it with people who are not Christians, and they're like, "What? You're asking me all these personal questions about money and what I think about kids and so on?" Like, yeah, because this is what you're signing up for when you get married. You're going to have to talk about all these things, and you're better doing it now when you've still got the chance to get out, basically, if it's not going to work. Next, be honest with each other about your flaws. If you're thinking of marrying somebody and they won't go there at talking about their flaws, they won't entertain it, red alarm bells should go off immediately. We've all got flaws. If you're not going to be open about them with a person you're marrying, you're not going to be open anywhere. And that'd be a major red flag to me if I was considering marrying somebody. And then finally, spend time with a couple who've been healthily married for a long time. Spend time with a couple who've been healthily married for a long time. They'll tell you what it's really like. A few laughs from some people who've been married for a while. Murray's lovely, right? Yeah, yeah. But those are some thoughts. Next thing, more sadly, if you're considering divorce, know that even if you're permitted to divorce before God because of the circumstances, you don't have to. I mean, if the other person chooses to, again, you don't have a choice, but you don't have to. The other person might have fulfilled the criteria of unfaithfulness. That doesn't mean you must get divorced. That means that before God, you can. You're free to. Again, talk to trusted friends alone and together. Ideally, people who know you well enough to speak truth into the situation. I think we're often far too private with our marriages. And while we don't share all of our stuff with everybody, we could share some of our stuff, or a lot of our stuff, with a few people more than we do. I am convinced by that. Think about why you're considering it, which may seem obvious, but if you're considering divorce, are the reasons anything to do with what Jesus says? Or are they driven by something else? Speak to church leaders. If you feel like your marriage is in a hard place, or it's really difficult, or just even it's heading in that direction, please speak to church leadership. Speak to me, speak to any of our elders. We would love to help chat with you. We're not going to say we're experts, but we can journey with you. But related to that, look into marriage counselling. There's loads of great organisations out there. And some of the helpful ones, Relate, Marriage Care, Care for the Family, Restored. There's loads of organisations that do different pieces at helping people either to get a marriage on track or sort of talk things through. There's loads of stuff out there. Next, though, how to support somebody considering divorce. We will probably all face this at some point. First obvious thing, listen. Don't steam in with an opinion, even if you don't like or you do like the other person. Don't steam in. Listen. Be very, very aware of giving specific advice. Remember, if a divorce happens, the implications are huge and not for you. They're huge for the other person. So be wary of giving very specific advice. Look to clarify reality. So asking questions beyond how the person feels, get into specifics. Now, why are you thinking, what's happened? What have they done? What have you done? Get into the specifics. Encourage them not to rush. Now, there might be a situation where somebody urgently needs to get physical distance. If there's an abusive situation and they just got to get out, Safe in Sussex is the place to go for help on that. And it might be appropriate to immediately get physical distance, but you never need to rush into a divorce. I can't think of an occasion where you need to rush the legal, side of it. You don't need to rush the divorce. You might need to rush the physical separation. If you know or suspect there's an abusive situation, try and help the person find safety. Don't take it all onto yourself, though. As I said, Safe in Sussex is apparently, from people I know who've used them, fantastic for help on that. But so finally on that, support them with any practicalities. If somebody is considering divorce, depending on the situation, there may be huge implications financially, living arrangements, so on. Where can you be of practical help, you and your group of friends? And then finally, and more briefly, how to support somebody who's been divorced. And the first thing is, if you've experienced divorce, you can suddenly be extremely isolated. Maybe you've built a network of friendships that's based on married couples. That happens quite a lot. Suddenly, you're not in that unit. What do friendships look like? Spend time with people who've just been divorced. Invite them into things. Invite them into your family and your home. Don't avoid the issue, but choose moments wisely, of course, when to talk about it. And finally, if they have children, see if there are particular ways to help. Because children, it's always bad for children when there's divorce. But the practicalities of that, if you're suddenly a single parent, and work, and immediately it can just be a very complicated situation. So how do we practically help people with that going on? I've just fired loads of practical thoughts at you. If there's one or two that resonate or you need for some situation in the future, I hope that's the case. But as I say, divorce is not always wrong. It's always there because wrong has been done. It's always a failure of love by somebody, but in itself, it's not always wrong. We're human. And so it's a sad reality. It's a concession because our hearts are hard. But just as I finish, a note of hope. In the Old Testament, there's a book called Hosea. And the story of Hosea is that there's a man called Hosea, and God tells him to marry a woman called Gomer, who is consistently unfaithful. And he does. And it's not very easy. It's a very strange story. And their marriage becomes a picture of God and his people. We talked a few weeks ago about how one story that runs through history is that Jesus is in some powerful way married to God's people. It's amazing. But we're all spiritual adulterers. We all cheat on God with other things. We behave like we're seeking a divorce from him all the time. But just like Hosea stayed with Gomer, God stays with us. Even though our hearts are hard, he is soft towards us. None of us will do marriage and relationships and singleness perfectly. We won't. But Jesus is the perfect spouse. Always committed, never adulterous, never abusive. And so there's hope. One day we will be in right relationship with all God's people. Divorce will be a thing of the past with all the things that cause it. Abuse will be gone. Loneliness will be gone. Family breakdown will be gone. And the ways of Jesus will be embraced and lived alongside him forever in the greatest marriage. That's a good note to end on, isn't it? I was going to suggest that we pray. What I'm going to do, I'm wary of time. I've spoken for a while. I'm just going to sit down for a few minutes, and I'd love it if people would just pray out, just a few of us, for the state of marriage in our church, in our country, for love over hard hearts, for divorce to decrease, for those called to be single, either now or for life, to find that calling with joy. So if I just sit down, could a few people just pray out, and then we're going to sing Never Once together, just to sort of round off our service. Let's pray.